Great trial lawyers are made, not born. Welcome to Verdict Academy, preserving trial wisdom for trial lawyers. Join host Kevin Morrison, trial attorney in San Francisco, as he recreates those invaluable hallway conversations that remote work has made rare. Candid insights and hard-won lessons from America's most accomplished trial lawyers. Produced and powered by Law Pods.
Welcome to another episode of Verdict Academy, where we bring you the best trial lawyers in the country to share their top three trial tips in 30 minutes. This episode's guest is the Honorable Mark W. Bennett. Judge Mark Bennett has been a trial lawyer in over 20 federal courts, has tried over 400 jury trials as a federal district judge in six districts, spanning the Middle District of Florida to the District of the Northern Mariana Islands. He's taught at five law schools, authored more than 25 law review articles, spoken at more than 500 CLE programs in 41 states and several foreign countries. He's mediated and arbitrated more than 620 matters, and perhaps most importantly, he's won a hot pepper eating contest judged by the Justice Clarence Thomas. Judge Bennett retired from the bench in 2019 as the Director Emeritus of Drake University Law School's Institute for Justice Reform and Innovation, and is a mediator and arbitrator with a national practice. I can tell you, I personally recommend an article he wrote titled Eight Traits of Great Trial Lawyers, A Federal Judge's View on How to Shed the Moniker, quote, I am a litigator, end quote, which is in the Review of Litigation and on his LinkedIn profile. If you're a student of all things jury trial, as I am, I strongly recommend you follow Judge Bennett on LinkedIn, where his thought-provoking and insightful ideas about the jury trial are a must-read. Judge Bennett, welcome to Verdict Academy.
Thank you so much, Kevin. It's a great honor to be here today. I very much appreciate it.
It's a great honor to have you on. We're going to get into the format of the show is three trial tips to our younger and less experienced attorneys and even older folks like me. But before we get there, Drew, you obviously love jury trial, right? It's a passion of yours.
Yes.
Yeah.
I bleed the Seventh Amendment.
Oh, you and I bleed the same blood, my friend. What drew you to become a courtroom lawyer and then a courtroom judge?
Well, thank you. Did not come from a family of lawyers. As a matter of fact, growing up, I didn't know a single lawyer. My mother was very ill and died when I was pretty young, and I was raised by an African-American kind of nanny that my father hired. And when I would come home from elementary school, I would sit on her lap and we would chat, and I would ask her about her growing up in the Twin Cities, Minneapolis, St. Paul. And I was kind of appalled by the discrimination that she encountered in her life. She was never bitter, ever, but just matter of fact. And I was curious, and so I asked her a lot of questions. And so from a very early age, I knew I wanted to become a civil rights lawyer and be a voice for people who needed a strong advocate.
How old were you when you started your relationship with her?
I was probably six or seven.
Okay. And this is in what time frame are we talking about?
1950.
Okay. So obviously, racial justice issues, voting rights, all that stuff was very hot topic. And
yes.
Got it. And so that basically at a very young age, then you were driven to do justice for folks like her.
Absolutely.
Wow. And you thought you could do that in a courtroom as opposed to some other area.
Yes. Well, right around a year or two after I met Tessie, my father was a children's dentist in downtown St. Paul. And I would take the city bus from where we lived, about a 20-minute bus ride, and I'd go to the public library across from where my dad's dental practice was. And then I'd meet him for lunch and then go back to the library, and then he would drive me home at the end of the day. And one day I got bored, and so I walked a couple more blocks down to the Ramsey County Courthouse in St. Paul. And I went in and I just happened to watch a trial, and it was a burglary trial. And I remember, I didn't think the defense lawyer was very good. And I thought, well, gee, why don't you ask these questions on cross-examination? And I thought, you know, I think I could do a better job than that, being the precocious child that I was. And so that was my first exposure to a courtroom. And I thought, I can do that.
got a little taste at a young age and you just can't get it out of your system.
Exactly. Still can't. That's right.
Incredible. So did you go to college with knowing that, hey, this is a path to law school and a path to the courtroom? Did you hear that whole mission?
Exactly. Yeah. I know most people in law school don't know what they're going to do, change their mind 3 or 4 times. I was just always focused on doing trial work. And I started off doing primarily civil rights and employment discrimination, although I did a few other things, but that was the primary focus of my practice. I also had a very substantial First Amendment practice, and that's the practice that got me into multiple federal courts around the country, in addition to some of my civil rights cases. I also did federal criminal defense, and that got me into other districts as well.
All right, well, let's get to the heart of it. We're going to have a nice conversation here about these three topics. Topic one, Judge Bennett, the use of questionnaires for jury selection. How do you feel about those and how do you use them?
I'm a huge believer in jury questionnaires. And when I was chief judge of the district, we had a fairly kind of standard questionnaire that the administrative officer will dump to federal courts with just basic information. A lot of federal judges would give the lawyers the morning of the jury trial that information. I thought, that doesn't work. So I expanded the questionnaire into things that I would want to know if I were a trial lawyer. And then we did something that was unusual. We sent those questionnaires out well in advance of trial. When they came into the clerk's office, we sent them to the lawyers in the case at least 7 days prior to the trial. We had a random jury selector, so we knew which of the first 14 jurors would be in the box. We disclosed that to the lawyers. We didn't disclose who would follow them because that would affect a lot of their judgments, but I wanted them to know early on, week before the trial started, who were the 14 jurors. They got copies of the questionnaires from all of the potential jurors that were being brought in. They just didn't know who was going to follow the 14 if some were challenged for cause or excluded. And then in major cases, we did a case-specific questionnaire. So for example, I had a trial that was scheduled to last 3 months. It did. We took 14 days in jury selection, picking the jury. We sent out that questionnaire 4 months prior to trial to 400 prospective jurors. We got them all back. It was sent out to the lawyers. And then I had the lawyers meet and confer, and they agreed that of that 400, 200 would just be poor jurors for both sides, and they eliminated those. And then when we brought jurors in small panels, I think it was 15 per day, they had all the questionnaires, and we had excluded the obvious ones that neither side thought would be a good juror, so we were able to run a Even though it took 15 days to pick a jury, we were able to run a much more efficient jury selection because my whole theory of being a trial judge was what was called the jury-centered approach to judging. And the question was, what would I want if I were a juror? And everything I did, including my no sidebar rules, I didn't allow sidebars, was aimed at what would jurors want. So I was a huge believer in jury questionnaires. I thought for the most part, when people were sitting in their living room filling out a questionnaire and had time to think about it, they weren't in an intimidating, beautiful federal courtroom with 28-foot high ceilings and very fancy courtroom. They were more at ease to actually be forthcoming about what they would say in the questionnaire. That's not to say that sometimes, once they got into the courtroom, they would get answers that were inconsistent with the questionnaire, and that's okay, because we could ferret out why that was. But I was just a huge believer in jury questionnaires and a huge believer in getting that information to the lawyers ahead of time so that they could process and think about it and not have to scramble the morning of trial. I never understood why judges did that. It made no sense to me whatsoever.
I'm laughing because this is music to my ears. This is a dream. This is what happens when you put a trial lawyer on the trial bench, someone who knows what they're doing. Why is the rest of the bench, especially the federal bench, so tough on this issue? So they either don't allow a questionnaire or they do. It's like 3 questions, name, rank, serial number, and you get, 62 seconds to do voir dire. Why is the rest of the bench, I would say, is it fair to say the rest of the bench does not adopt this practice, Judge? Would you agree with that?
Yes, I would agree with that. I think there's a culture in most districts that it's always been done that way. That's the way we're going to do it. So the new judges come in, particularly judges that haven't had extensive trial experience. And then they go to new judges school, what we call baby judges school. And they learn about being a managerial judge. It just flies in the face of what would jurors want and what would trial lawyers want. What's a better way to conduct a trial?
You obviously know how to do it. Is there any tips you can give us as to how we can persuade a judge to change his or her mind and, you know, maybe not go to your dream level, but at least get better in this area?
I think one thing that's helpful is, so in the case where we spent 15 days in jury selection, I had a lot of input into the jury questionnaire. It was not a simple questionnaire. It had 99 questions, pared down from about 200 that the lawyers suggest. And I worked with the lawyers, and we agreed on the 99 questions. So I think one of the big tips is, if the judges have to do the work, they're not going to do it because they think they're overworked. So if the lawyers can agree and work on a questionnaire and say to the judge, we've agreed on the questionnaire, we would like the assistance of the clerk's office to send it out, then there's less work for the judge. There's not a whole lot of work for the staff because it's all sent out electronically. And if the lawyers agree to it, you'd have to be kind of a real jerk of a judge not to go along with it. Although I suppose some wouldn't because they haven't done it that way. But at least you've eliminated the problem of the judge having to do any extra work.
That's obviously a huge issue. The issue that I run into, it's going to take too much time. And I always tell the judge, Your Honor, the time that we're going to spend up front is going to reduce the actual trial time. So if you want to put me on the clock, put me on the clock, include this, and I'll take it out of my trial presentation. They don't seem to, it's just so novel to them. They just can't seem to follow that. Got any, anything I can do?
You know, most judges didn't allow the lawyers to actually participate in jury selection. They would have them submit questions. I partnered with the lawyers at the pretrial, and they knew from my scheduling and management order that they could have as much participation as they wanted, as long as it was reasonable. And sometimes I was horrified. They wanted me to do it all. Well, I was glad to do it. I had a kind of a canned power. I did all my jury selection in PowerPoint, and I would adjust it for the case, but they wanted me to do it. I would say, no, it's your case. I allowed the lawyers to participate. You know, I'd heard other judges complaining about they'll ask inappropriate questions. Never once did I have a lawyer ask what I thought was an inappropriate question in jury selection. They just didn't do it. So, you know, sometimes they wanted me to handle the difficult issues. Sometimes, against my better judgment, they wanted to handle it, which was fine. When I say against my better judgment, I thought I did a little bit better job sometimes than the lawyers did, but sometimes they did a great job. But it's their case. So you should tailor the case to meet the objectives of the lawyers. And when you have really good lawyers, they get along really well, and you can give them a lot of slack because they're not going to abuse it.
I couldn't agree with you more, and I just wish more of the bench adopted your view. We'd get better trials, get better results.
Absolutely. We would get fairer results.
Fairer result. That's what I mean by that. You get actual less biased jurors who actually weeded out the biases that always exist. It doesn't matter what kind of a case, criminal defense, real estate deals, whatever it is. You'd weed that stuff out. Incredible. You get fair results. Wow.
I'm working as a consultant now on a case in a state on the West Coast, and the judge is allowing the lawyers to submit 3 proposed questions that he or she may or may not ask. I came up with what I thought were 9 really good questions and told the lawyers on this team, you know, if you think any of them are helpful, pick the 3 that you might want to submit. But it's like, what? You're only allowing them to submit 3 questions? This is a really important case, potential multi-million-dollar case, and you're not allowing the lawyers to ask questions, and you're only letting them submit 3 questions. Why would you do that? Because it's always been done that way.
Yeah. Laziness, always been done, and a fear that the time's going to, you know, they got all these cases on their case list, and the case they're managing cases, and they're afraid that this is going to take an inordinate amount of time. I think that's got to be part of it.
Can I just tell you one story about it's always been done this way?
Please.
Early in my career as a federal district judge, I had this lady in the front row. We were on the first day of the actual trial. She was elderly, and she raised her hand, and she said, well, gee, I don't know what to do. A juror raised their hand. So I said, yes, ma'am. She said, well, I've got a question for you. I noticed you're drinking. I As she said, it's probably water. Everybody else in the courtroom has water. We don't have anything to drink. Why is that? And I looked at her and said, well, you're not going to like my answer because it's always been done that way. But you know what? I'm going to change that. And on the next break, you can bring in anything you want to drink as long as it's non-alcoholic. And within 2 weeks, I had cup holders installed in the jury box so that jurors could bring in anything they wanted to drink. But the it's always been done that way is not a satisfying answer to anyone. It's just not, because there's a better way to do everything. Yeah, Thomas Edison said, there's a better way to do everything, go find it. And I felt as my job as a lawyer and as a judge was to go find it.
It is not.
Right?
Let's move to the next topic, opening statements. Why are most opening statements dead on arrival?
Well, thank you, Kevin. In my judgment, most opening statements are dead on arrival because most lawyers are not very good storytellers. And it would make my skin crawl in opening statement when a lawyer, let's say they had 6 witnesses in the case. So they would say, the witness will be Joe Blow from Kokomo, and here's what he's going to say. And our next witness would be Jane Doe from Kokomo. Here's what she's going to say. It was just piecemeal. It didn't tell a cohesive story. So most lawyers do not know how to tell a story that motivates jurors to rule in favor of their client, whatever their respective story is. They're just not good storytellers. And that's the primary problem with opening statements. I'll give you an example. It happens to me from a criminal. Some criminal defense lawyers watch your podcast. Yeah.
Anybody who does trial, I hope, is listening. So go ahead.
So I had a lawyer who did a fair amount of criminal defense work. She was a D-plus lawyer on a really good day. She went to a trial college for like a couple weeks or a month. She came back, she was trying a criminal case, and she gave the best opening statement, one of the best I had ever heard. It was a cocaine conspiracy case. The government had the bricks of the kilos of cocaine on the evidence table. She picked up a kilo, and she told the opening statement as if the kilo could talk. And it was, okay, so this kilo, who did you first meet in this conspiracy? And she went through everybody, and then, did you ever meet my client? Nope, you never met your client. It was captivating. And she went from a D-plus lawyer on a good day to a solid A lawyer. That opening statement was fabulous because she told the story from a unique point of view. Point of view is really important. She told the point of view from the drug evidence. It was, I never would have thought of that on my own. It was brilliant. And she told a great story and got her first not guilty verdict.
Yes, story. Look, our brains as humans are hardwired to listen to stories since we were all gathered around the campfire, you know, millennia ago. We were telling stories, right? That's how you communicate. And so our brains are desperate to hear story and they love the story. You say, let me tell you the story. And it, ooh, you mean like, oh, a story. It's story time, right?
Exactly. And in my 8 Traits article, I give examples of some of my favorite TED Talks, people who are really good storytellers. And so you can model it after it's an acquired skill. One day when my daughter was maybe 6 years old, I took her to a public library to listen to a professional storyteller. And I was captivated. And at the end, I went up to her. I said, have you ever thought about going to law school? And she laughed. She said, no. She said, well, why would you say that? And I explained it to her that you do what most lawyers are unable to do, incapable of doing, right?
The litany of the evidence. Let's list the evidence. And eyes glaze over, you know, as jurors start thinking, let's see, who's picking up the kids today? Where's the laundry? Yeah, fantastic tip. Third, tips for improving direct examination. I think direct is often viewed as, quote, easy, that people overlook it. They kind of mail it in. That's my view on direct. Tell us about how you improve direct exam.
Yeah, I think direct is actually much harder than cross. I see a lot of lawyers that are pretty good at cross, sometimes even very good. I see very few that are very good on direct. So here are the problems with direct. Most lawyers have their questions written out. And if they have 16 questions, they're going to ask all 16 questions come hell or high water. They don't even listen to the answer of the witness. So a great direct is where you have...
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Are you suggesting trial lawyers are supposed to listen?
The greatest trial lawyers are the best listeners. Most lawyers are not good listeners, period. They don't pick on cues during oral argument when I'm asking questions. They don't listen to the witness because they're so hell-bent on asking the next question, they don't listen to what the answer to the first question is. And so, yeah, if you want to write out your questions, fine, write them out and then put them aside. Ask a question, listen to the witness, and then I think you probably had other people talk about looping. You take the witness's answer and you repeat part of that answer to form your next question. It's just like you're having a conversation with a neighbor in your backyard over the fence line. You don't have written out questions. The best, deepest, most interesting conversations, you don't have questions written out. You listen to the person and you ask follow-up questions, right? So when my wife and I go to parties, she likes to meet everybody at the party and have kind of a superficial. I like to focus on one person and I will get to know that person so well because I ask questions, I listen, I'm not concerned about me saying anything, I'm listening and I'm asking follow-up questions. And at the end of 2 hours, they think I'm one of their best friends because I've listened to them. And that's what you need to do. I'll give you another example. There was a really terrific trial lawyer. He was very interesting. He tried both civil and criminal cases in front of me. And we were trying a very difficult case. And he took his chair from behind counsel table, picked it up. He called his client to do a direct, picked up the chair, moved it up to the witness box, sat about a foot from his client, folded his hands and started talking and having a conversation. No notes, just a conversation. And I felt like we were all in a living room eavesdropping on this conversation. And the jurors were in rapture because he changed the dynamic of the courtroom to have a very intimate conversation. It was dramatic and it was compelling. But he knew how to do a direct examination by asking simple questions. That's another thing. Most lawyers can't ask simple questions. Simple questions are the key to direct examination.
Who, what, when, where, why, basically, and talk, essentially.
Yes. My very first trial, I was a magistrate judge, first week on the job. And my colleague had some cases down at the state prison in Fort Madison, Iowa. And I said, I'd love to go down and do them for you. She said, great. So I went down. Very first case, it was he beat me up on the way to the shower, case against the guard. So pro se plaintiff calls the first witness. Did you see Joe Blow beat me up on the way to the shower? No. No further questions. Okay. He had six witnesses. We're through five witnesses in less than 10 minutes. Gets to the sixth witness. Didn't even ask the witness his name. Just said, did you see Guard Joe Blow beat me up on the way to the shower? Yes. Best follow-up question I've ever seen in a trial. What did you see? Very few lawyers would ask a question that simple. It was brilliant. Simple.
Why is also key. Why is one of my favorites. You know, during whatever deposition, because deposition to me is like trial. Well, this is blah, 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 blah. And they're prepared to say that. And you say, why? And then you really get the answer. You really get what they're thinking.
Yes.
100%. It's so critical.
Absolutely.
My goodness, it's gone so fast. I could do this again. You know what? I'm going to break my rule of three and just add one more. One of your interests is why deposing experts is a waste of time and money. Tell us about that, Judge Bennett.
When I say I rarely depose the other side's expert, I mean rarely.
Now, just to be clear, this is in federal court where you've got the report that is supposed to lay out all the opinions, right? That's what we're talking about. Because some state courts, as you know, don't have that. And anyways.
They don't have reports, but you can require the other side to give all of the opinions of the expert, even though there may not be a report, I think, in most states that I'm familiar with. So here's my point. You need to pin down what the expert is going to testify through discovery, but you don't need to take their deposition. The problem with taking the deposition is most lawyers give away how they're going to approach that witness on cross-examination. That's the last thing you want to ever do. And so I required experts to fully disclose. I would lock them in through the interrogatories. Now, I did take an expert witness one time in New York City. And I told the other lawyer, I'd like to take the deposition of this expert. He wasn't from New York either. I said, but only if we do it at the expert's office. He said, why? I said, that's just my rule. He said, okay. We went into the expert's office. I introduced myself. I said, now, I've read your report. Do you have anything you want to add to your report? No. Do you understand that if you decide to add or delete anything from your report, you have an obligation to supplement your interrogatory answers? So I know that. Do you understand that? Yes. And do you think that's fair to require you to do that? Absolutely. I said, well, it's very nice to meet you. I'm done. It lasted less than 7 minutes. Now, here's what I did during those 7 minutes. That was back then. I was much younger. I had a good memory. I memorized the name of every single treatise he had within arm's reach. I then went out and bought those treatises. When it came time to cross-examine him, he thought, who is this goofball that came all the way to Iowa, to New York, and didn't ask me anything about my opinions? This guy must be a flake. So I pull out of my second brief bag the books of these treatises, and I go through them and ask them if he recognizes them as an authoritative treatise. And he would say yes. And then I said, as a matter of fact, don't you have these within arm's length in your office? Yes, I do. And you have them within arm's length because they're important to you and you like to be able to consult with them quickly. And I did the bolstering, you know, the accrediting of him. And then I proceeded to tear him apart with things in the treatises that he had recognized. But that was one of the very few times I deposed an expert. I didn't see any value in it. Cost the clients a lot of time and money. I just didn't need to do it. Now, I would be loaded for bear. I would read everything the expert wrote. I would try and find other cases where the expert had testified to. Now it's so easy with the internet and you get access. I don't understand the reason to take opposing party's expert. I just don't get it.
Yeah, you got to save the good stuff for trial, 100%. I never understood these five-hour depths of the expert that try to fillet him. What are you showing all your good stuff for, man? Save it for the jury.
When you don't depose the other side expert and they're used to having their deposition, it makes them kind of nervous. Either they totally underestimate you and they just think you're a flake, or they think, what is this guy up to that he doesn't have to depose me?
It totally does. Yep.
Right?
100%.
About either one, right?
100%. He's either totally incompetent or a genius. Flew by the half hour. Any final words to younger trial attorneys, you know, trying to figure out how to get better in this profession, Judge?
Yeah, you learn more from your failures than your successes. It's really good to watch other lawyers, but it's really important to do a postmortem after everything you do to try and think of how you could do better. I have a mantra that I say every morning when I wake up. What can I do better today that I've never done before? And I'm a lifelong learner. I'm always trying to improve my craft. I had a very difficult mediation on Saturday. It went better than it probably should have. Great lawyers. And my postmortem was very short. But sometimes my postmortem can be pretty long. Why did I make that mistake? You know, I've made that mistake before. Why do I keep making it? And so don't beat yourself up too bad if you make a mistake. But always try and learn from your mistakes and try and learn from others. If you have a spare moment and you know there's some really good lawyers at your local courthouse trying a case, go watch them. When I would hire law clerks, I hired great law clerks, but I would tell them, you're really going to learn more what not to do than you're going to learn what to do, because we're going to see a few great lawyers, but a lot of pretty marginal lawyers. But it's a great learning experience either way.
Incredible. Judge Mark W. Bennett, it's been a pleasure and an honor to have you on Verdict Academy. Thank you for your time, sir.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it, Kevin.
Thank you for listening to Verdict Academy. If today's insights resonated with you, please subscribe and share with colleagues. In a world where we see each other less, learning from experienced trial lawyers matters now more than ever. Join us next time. Produced and powered by Law Pods.